Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr., Kelly Jean Kelly, and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
Vietnam plans to start using liquefied natural gas, or LNG, by the year 2020. Although Vietnam has said it would be hurt by the effects of climate change, it plans to move forward with plans to import LNG. The decision shows how difficult it is to balance energy costs with efforts to protect the environment. Lê Văn Lu is with Vietnam's Ministry of Industry and Trade. He said that, as the economy grows, energy supplies have not kept up with demand. He said that, for many years, his country was an energy exporter. However, in 2015, we became a net energy importer, especially of coal and natural gas, he added. Vietnam is home to nearly 100 million people. It was among the nations that sent representatives to the recent climate change talks in Katowice, Poland. The United Nations gathering failed to set targets for the reduction of carbon gases linked to rising temperatures in Earth's atmosphere. Southeast Asian countries, such as Indonesia and Thailand, plan to burn more coal to meet their energy needs, yet they fear the effects of climate change. Vietnam is turning to imports of liquefied natural gas, partly because policymakers believe there are limits to renewable energy. Lu notes that the country is reaching the upper limit of electricity production from dams. Wind and solar power are more costly than LNG. The United States wants Vietnam to use LNG because U.S. companies could export it. Last week, the U.S. government organized a conference on natural gas. At the event, the U.S. Consul General in Ho Chi Minh City, Mary Tarnuka, warned of energy shortages in southern Vietnam. She said that the city has economic growth of 10%, but energy is needed to fuel that growth. All of this is creating a growing middle class and a society and culture that is growing as quickly as their energy demands, she said. Tarnuka added that demand for energy is growing at nearly 8% this year. Natural gas has traditionally been transported through pipelines. But for longer distances, it can be cooled into a liquid so that it can be shipped in containers. In this way, LNG could be transported across the Pacific Ocean from U.S. businesses. Once it arrives, Vietnam needs technology to turn LNG back into gas so it can be used as fuel. U.S. companies and government agencies are advising on the necessary infrastructure and equipment. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
People in Japan pay good money to eat the deadly pufferfish. There, the food is called fugu. The fish can cost more than $100 a kilogram. Eating fugu is especially popular now, during the winter holiday season. But in the last few years, the fugu market has seen a change. The part of the ocean where pufferfish live is warming quickly. In answer, pufferfish are traveling north to find cooler water. Along the way, new kinds of poisonous fish are being created. These pufferfish hybrids worry government officials. They are afraid people will accidentally eat them and die. The Japanese government has ordered fishermen and fish traders to throw away any hybrids that they catch. Some industry workers strongly object to the order. They note that hybrids have poison in the same areas as regular pufferfish. Trained cooks and fish butchers know how to remove the areas that contain the poison. Usually, the poison is in the fish's liver and reproductive organs, or sometimes the skin or muscle. Naoto Ito leads a seafood processing company in the city of Shimonoseki. He disagrees with the government's rule to throw away pufferfish hybrids. "But we have to follow the rules," he says, "because if there's any problems, it leads to hysteria." The Japanese take pufferfish danger seriously. A supermarket in western Japan once accidentally sold some pufferfish that had not had their poisonous livers removed. The town used its missile alert system to warn residents. The danger linked to the fish may be one reason for its popularity. One man who fishes for pleasure said, "Some people like it when they feel a bit of tingling on their lips." A high-end fish seller adds that the fish tastes good, but the seller, Koichi Kushida, notes that pufferfish hybrids are a concern. As more hybrids appear in the market, Kushida checks all the fish himself. But in truth, even experienced fish handlers and scientists cannot always identify the hybrids. The one certainty is that the hybrid population is increasing. And this rise of mixed pufferfish is another example of the effects climate change is having on sea creatures. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
An Israeli company says it has produced the world's first steak grown in a laboratory. Researchers from Tel Aviv-based Aleph Farms say they successfully created the meat using methods that do not harm animals. The company claims its scientific invention has the true texture and structure of beef muscle tissue steak. Shulamit Levenberg is the co-founder and chief scientific officer of Aleph Farms. She considers the company's product clean meat. She says this is because it is grown in a clean, controlled setting and does not require the killing of an animal. Some opponents of lab meat production have rejected the term clean meat and suggested that synthetic meat would be more exact. Many companies have attempted to create realistic meat replacements with mostly vegetable-based products. Others, like U.S.-based company Just, also have plans to produce beef grown inside a lab. The process begins when scientists collect live cell tissue from real cows. Aleph Farms says this is easily completed without harming the animals. The cells are then fed nutrients to make them grow. The cells are then combined through a process the company says uses three-dimensional or 3D technology to form realistic tissue. The company says small pieces of meat can be produced in as little as 3 weeks, with each costing about $50 to make. Levenberg says animal meat grown in a controlled setting has mostly been limited to simple structures of one or two kinds of cell tissue. This has meant companies have struggled to produce a lab-grown meat that enjoys the similar texture, shape, and taste of real steak. So far, cell-created meat development has been limited to ground meat. Levenberg said Aleph Farms uses four different kinds of animal cells found in traditional cuts of meat. As a result, it can produce a product containing similar properties of steak, including muscle, fat, and connective tissues. The company considers this the key to a product that will be closer to the beef that people crave. Aleph Farms includes a video on its website that shows its steaks being cooked, prepared, and eaten. The company is still developing its technology in an effort to bring production costs down. The steak product is expected to be ready to sell within 2 years. Aleph Farms hopes the process can greatly reduce the amount of land, water, and food resources necessary for traditional beef production methods. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization has estimated that demand for meat is likely to grow by nearly 70% by 2050. The UN says such demand could create resource shortages around the world and have harmful effects on the environment. Earlier this year, Dutch company Mosa Meat announced plans to make and sell laboratory-grown meat in restaurants by 2021. The company has been developing its methods since announcing in 2013 it had produced the world's first hamburger in a lab. Mosa Meat uses a similar scientific process for creating beef. But instead of steak, Mosa Meat plans to begin its market launch with ground beef products, mainly for making hamburgers. The company says its production process uses 96% less greenhouse gas emissions than traditional meat production. In addition, it says it requires 99% less land and 96% less water. I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. James Madison of Virginia was elected President of the United States in 1808. He was inaugurated in Washington on March 4, 1809. The people of the city were happy with the new president, but the nation was not yet sure what kind of leader he would be. Madison's first 4 years were not easy. He had to deal with a foreign policy problem that the former president, Thomas Jefferson, was not able to solve: increasingly tense relations with Britain. Historian Alan Taylor has written several books on early American history and has won a Pulitzer Prize for his writing. He says Madison took office under difficult circumstances.
Jefferson, in many ways, was a tough act to follow because he'd been extraordinarily popular. But he had made one great policy mistake with Madison's support. Madison had been his Secretary of State. And that mistake was something known as the embargo.
The embargo had arisen from a war between Britain and France. The two nations refused to honor America's neutrality. Each tried to prevent the United States from trading with the other. Both interfered with American shipping, and the British Navy sometimes seized American sailors. President Jefferson ordered a ban on trade with Europe, but the embargo failed to end the hostile acts against the United States. A month after Madison took office, the British minister in Washington, David Erskine, said Britain would stop seizing American ships if the United States would trade again with Britain. But Erskine did not make clear that the British government demanded several conditions. One condition was that the United States continue the ban against trade with France. Another was that Britain be permitted to capture American ships that violated the law. President Madison did not accept these conditions, but he still believed he had reached an agreement with the British minister. He announced that the United States would reopen trade with Britain. Hundreds of ships left American ports. But a few weeks later, Madison received surprising news. The British government had rejected the agreement he reached with Erskine. Letters were exchanged, but Madison could not get a good explanation for what had happened. He finally broke off all communications, and Erskine and his replacement left Washington. America's policy of trade with Britain and France continued to be a serious issue. President Madison approved trade with all countries in 1810. But when relations with Britain did not improve, he stopped trade with the country again in the spring of 1811. Trade was not the only problem, however. A growing number of Americans believed that the British were helping some Native Americans to fight the United States. As the people of the United States began to move to the northern and western territories, the government made treaties with the different Indian tribes. The treaties explained which land belonged to the Indians and which land could be settled by white people. The settlers did not always honor the treaties. Historian Alan Taylor explains that Indian tribes were trying to defend their homelands. He says they asked the British to provide them with guns and ammunition to fight against the American settlements.
And the British were playing a very ambivalent game. In other words, they wanted to keep the Indians on a kind of retainer. In the eventuality that war did happen, they would want to mobilize those Indians. So they did provide them with guns and ammunition, but they hoped that the native peoples would just use them on the defensive.
A leader of the Shawnee Indian tribe, Tecumseh, decided to unite all Indians and help them defend against the settlers. Throughout the West, many Americans believed that the British in Canada were responsible for Tecumseh's efforts. They demanded war with Britain to destroy the power of the tribes. In Washington, a new Congress was meeting. Some of the new members were very different from the men who had controlled Congress before. They were less willing to compromise and more willing to defend America's interests. They soon got the name War Hawks. At the same time, America had a new Secretary of State. Madison chose his close friend, James Monroe. What the United States did not have at that troubled time was a representative in Britain. The British minister in Washington, Francis James Jackson, returned to London when Madison broke off communications. The American minister in London, William Pinckney, sailed home as well. There was no official in either capital to report what was happening. And in the spring of 1812, the United States and Britain were moving closer to war. President Madison had hoped for some sign of compromise, but he was sure there would be war. He had seen the instructions from London to Britain's new minister in Washington, Augustus Foster. The foreign minister warned Foster to say nothing about any compromise. He wanted the United States to see how firmly Britain would stand against neutral trade with its enemies. Also, historian Alan Taylor says the United States did not believe Britain would stop inspecting American ships and taking away any sailors the British thought were British subjects.
And because the British would not change that policy, and the United States was determined to try to force them to change that policy, that's why the war happened.
In the United States, Congress continued to prepare the nation for war. Lawmakers voted to increase the size of the army and to borrow money to pay for things the larger army would need. But not all lawmakers wanted war with Britain. Many Federalists especially opposed it. Congressman Hermanus Bleeker showed the House a list of hundreds of names from his area of New York. He said all these people opposed the embargo and the idea of war with Britain. It is impossible, he said, that we can go to war when the embargo ends 60 days from now. Where are our armies, our navy, Have we the money to fight a war? Why, it would be treason to go to war this soon, so poorly prepared. Treasury Secretary Albert Gallatin was having a difficult time finding money to borrow. He could get almost no money at all from Federalist bankers in the New England states in the Northeast. Congress had approved borrowing $11 million, but Gallatin found the banks would lend only $6 million to the federal government. The Federalists charged that Gallatin's difficulties showed that the people did not want war, especially the people of New England. If the people of the West and the South wanted to fight, then let them pay for the war. Yet, sure that Britain would not change its hostile policies, President Madison sent a secret message to Congress on June 1st, proposing that war be declared. Madison listed the reasons for war. British warships had violated the American flag at sea. The British Navy had seized and carried off persons protected by the flag. British warships also violated United States waters, interfering with American ships as they entered and left port. Another reason, he said, was Britain's orders against trade with France or allies of France. International law, he said, gave Britain no right to make such orders. Madison also spoke of the hostile Indians of the Northwest Territory and seemed to charge British Canada with helping the Indians. The president's message went to the Foreign Affairs Committee of the House of Representatives for discussion. The final vote in the House on declaring war was 79-4 and 49 against. In the Senate, the vote was closer, 19-4 and 13 against. President Madison signed the bill into law on June 18th. The War of 1812 had begun. The leaders in Washington did not know it, but 2 days earlier, Britain had ended its orders against neutral American trade. The orders might have been withdrawn earlier, except for a number of events. British Prime Minister Spencer Perceval, under great political pressure, had decided to end the British orders on neutral trade. Businesses and traders were loudly protesting that the orders were destroying England's economy. On May 11th, before Perceval could act, he was shot to death. Not until June 8th was agreement reached on a new prime minister, Lord Liverpool. 8 days later, his government announced that the orders were ended immediately. This was only 2 days before war was to be declared in Washington, and with ships being the only method of communication, the British action was not learned of in time. If the United States had had a minister in London during the spring of 1812, the diplomat would have been able to report progress toward ending the orders. But the American minister, William Pinckney, had returned home a year earlier.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.